Welcome to CME on ReachMD. This activity, entitled Optimizing the Care and Quality of Life for Patients with AD-PKD, Part 3, Management, is jointly provided by Access Medical Education and Novus Medical Education and is supported by an educational grant from Otsuka America Pharmaceutical, Incorporated. Prior to beginning the activity, please be sure to review the faculty and commercial support disclosure statements as well as the learning objectives.
Hello and welcome to this webcast titled Optimizing the Care for Patients with AD-PKD. This is part three of four in CME series on improving the care and quality of life for patients suffering from autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease or AD-PKD. In this webcast, we'll talk about disease state management. I'm Dr. Frederick Robario-Scui. I'm a professor of medicine at Emory University. And I'm joined today by my colleague, Dr. Michelle Chanchol from the University of Colorado. Dr. Chanchol, would you please introduce yourself?
Thank you, Fred. It's an honor to be doing this webcast with you. And as you, I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado and with expertise in PKD research and clinical care of PKD patients.
Thank you very much. Objectives of this webcast are to review the general management of AD-PKD regarding particularly blood pressure, cholesterol control, and dietary interventions, apply current guidelines for initiation and management of tolvaptan in rapid progressors, and also summarize the dietary modifications that have shown benefit in AD-PKD. As the research over the last 40 years pretty much has shown, there's a number of interventions that we can work on and strategies that we can actually optimize the care of the PKD patients. Number one and most important point is hypertension. We know that the prevalence of hypertension is very high in PKD. At the time of diagnosis of PKD, for whatever reason, you know, either routine screening or a problem, about 40 to 60% of PKD patients already have hypertension. If you look at the pediatric population, up to 20% based on the series actually report that even kids with PKD already have abnormal blood pressure readings. And if you look at the end of life of PKD patients, the lifetime risk is almost about 90%. The 10% of people with PKD who don't develop hypertension typically do very well, and their kidney progression is not that bad. So this is clearly the most preventable and treatable risk factor for progression. We have several strategies and medications to choose from, and we always recommend the renin-angiotensin system blockers. Because there's an intrarenal activation of this system that occurs very early in PKD. Therefore, agents such as ACE inhibitors and ARBs should be considered as first-line drugs. Because the salt intake is typically high in our diet in the United States, diuretics are second-line recommended for management of blood pressure. And third-line is beta blockers. And the fourth-line, calcium channel blockers should be kept to the last line. And the reason for that is a defective calcium trafficking issue that is caused by polycystin defect and mutation in PKD mimics the effect of the calcium channel blockers. So obviously, if we can manage blood pressure with something else, we should choose the other agents first. And if we still have a high blood pressure and that's not controlled, then we should come down to using calcium channel blockers. I would ask you, Michelle, as far as the blood pressure goals based on the HALT-PKD trial, what is your guidelines and management strategies that you have as far as what is a good blood pressure goal in PKD patients?
Yeah, thank you, Fred. First of all, I really enjoy your initial slide where you touch on all the key clinical aspects that the clinicians should be aware in the management of patients with polycystic kidney disease. And as you mentioned, hypertension is honestly a key clinical parameter that needs to be in control in this patient population. As you mentioned, both of our centers were part of the HALT-PKD trials, and we have a lot of expertise with the management of blood pressure in this patient population. And you are very well aware that there were two studies where they look at blood pressure control in those patients with a GFR greater than 60, as well as patients with true CKD defined as a GFR less or equal than 60. And in that patient population with normal or near normal kidney function, I do agree that blood pressure should be less than 110 over 75. As the late Dr. Bob Schreier used to say, who actually was the principal investigator from the HALT study, the lower the better. And for patients with a GFR less than 60 and with more progressive renal disease, also agree with you in the basis of the HALT study and actually the SPRINT study, even though it did not include patients with polycystic kidney disease, that the systolic blood pressure should be below 130 towards closer to 120 as much as possible.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Now we're moving to the V2 receptor antagonists, and tolvaptan is the only agent of the class that has a label for polycystic kidney disease. So a series of clinical trials actually led to the science that's behind the effectiveness and safety of tolvaptan. And finally, in the United States, it was approved in April of 2018. The two trials, TEMPO and REPRISE, basically showed very similar effects, and they have a radical protective effect on the kidney function in about by a 31% lower annual rate of decline in GFR. If you compare that to the gold standard that we've had prior to that, which was basically using ARBs or ACE inhibitors, if you take a comparison point with ARBs in diabetic nephropathy, that benefit was only about 15.2% in annual rate of decline of GFR. And this is really clearly superior to that protection. I would like to ask Michelle just to very quickly go over the two seminal trials, the TEMPO 3-4 and the REPRISE trial, to see what was different between the two trials and how did we conduct these trials and what did we see after that as far as results.
Thanks, Fred. I agree that tolvaptan has really added to our armamentarium of how to deal and treat patients with polycystic kidney disease. As you mentioned, there were two key trials in the tolvaptan program, the TEMPO 3-4, as well as the REPRISE. Both of them, a very large population, over 1,000 patients with polycystic kidney disease. The time frame is the TEMPO was an earlier study between 2010 to 2013, and the REPRISE somewhat later between 2015 to 2017. The REPRISE included patients all the way to 64, and TEMPO was mainly 18 to 50. But the big difference, to your point, is that TEMPO included patients with GFR greater than 60, and the REPRISE had patients with GFRs between 45 to 65 and 25 to 44. So in other words, patients with more advanced chronic kidney disease. There's no question that another big difference between the two studies in the TEMPO, they look at total kidney volume requirement to be in the study, and actually changes in total kidney volume was an endpoint, and that was not the case in REPRISE. REPRISE really, the main primary outcome was changing in GFR in contrary to total kidney volume. So those, I think that focusing on the inclusion criteria as well as the outcomes were kind of the main key differences between TEMPO 3-4 and REPRISE.
Thank you very much. These are basically the graphs from New England Journal of Medicine. The TEMPO 3-4 results on the left side basically showed a net almost 1.2 milliliter per minute of kidney protection per year of usage and exposure to tolvaptan in TEMPO. And as far as the total kidney volume, patients who were on placebo, they had about 5.5% increase in the total kidney volume per year versus 2.8 for the patients who were on tolvaptan. Obviously, in REPRISE, we did not have a TKV endpoint. We only had a GFR endpoint. And the GFR endpoint was extremely close to what we were seeing in TEMPO. And it was basically paralleling and mimicking exactly those results. So the two trials were complementary, but very consistent with each other. And that's basically what gave birth to the science behind the regulatory approvals in all the countries that actually tolvaptan became available in. There are models to extrapolate the effect of tolvaptan on kidney function and the onset of end-stage renal disease or dialysis or transplantation. We assume that the earlier you start and the higher the GFR is, the more you're going to get actually a benefit of postponing dialysis. Based on tempo, we think that if you start tolvaptan around the GFR of 90, you could actually postpone dialysis by 7.5 years almost, versus if you start at 30 of GFR, you would only have about 1.5 years of difference in the onset of ESRD. So the sooner the better. The Reprise had very similar projections and extrapolations. If you started around 60, you're gaining about 6.8 years time of onset of dialysis. Or if you start at 30, you're only reaching about 2.3 years. So again, the sooner the better, and the higher the GFR, the better as far as the protection that you're getting from tolvaptan. And I'm going to ask Michelle now, as far as for any drug, you know, you have risks and benefits. And I would like him to basically summarize what are the benefits and what are the risks of considering tolvaptan.
Yeah, no, thanks, Fred. I wanted to make a comment on your previous slide that although when we see the data from the clinical trials, maybe the differences don't appear tremendously clinically significant, it's important to remind the clinician that these are additive. And these extrapolations are really bringing the point that these benefits add through the years, and potentially we can significantly delay progression to end-stage kidney disease in patients with polycystic kidney disease. Regarding the risk-benefit ratio, you're absolutely right. I mean, like any drug, I mean, what tolvaptan has been proven to show is that it slows kidney growth, it slows EGFR, kidney function decline, it will delay the need for kidney replacement therapy. Very important for us to keep in mind, it reduces pain, hematuria, kidney stone, as well as urinary tract infection events, and it may even have an effect on blood pressure reduction. Nonetheless, it does have some side effects like polyuria nocturia. It does increase thirst and fatigue. It has been shown to elevate uric acid, and it may be at times associated with gout. One of the harms that people are most concerned is about this elevation of transaminase and the risk of severe hepatocellular toxicity or liver failure. Nonetheless, this is the reason why these patients need very frequent monitoring of liver function, may have some possible drug interactions, and there's no question that the drug is expensive and it may create some financial burden. However, it's been the coverage of the tolvaptan, at least here in Colorado, has improved significantly since it was launched out in the community.
The next topic is really kidney stones that could happen in about 20% of PKD patients over their lifespan. What is atypical with PKD is that most people with PKD actually would make uric acid stones, which is kind of contrary to the garden variety calcium oxalate stones that non-PKD patients will have. There is an issue with hypocitraturia, so the citrate level in the urine are lower in PKD patients, and the stone former typically, you know, have hypocitraturia. Therefore, the treatment includes, you know, what we recommend typically to all stone formers, drinking plenty of fluid, at least 3 liters of water a day, a low salt diet, alkalinizing the urine if your uric acid stones are present, and also supplementing the diet with citrate and citrate tablets. And if we have a kidney stone that's stuck in the kidney, you know, we can consider lithotripsy and take them out to avoid, you know, obstruction issues and pain issues. The other topic is the urinary tract infections. Urinary tract infections are basically a big topic. They're very common in PKD. Most PKD patients during their lifetime would get at least one episode, whether it's going to be a bladder infection, a true kidney infection with pyelonephritis, or sometimes just an individual cyst infection that basically behaves like an abscess. We can see all these problems in PKD patients. We typically recommend doing a urine culture in all PKD patients who have symptoms of UTI. There's going to be burning, frequency, fever, chills. And if they have a kidney function, the difference with non-PKD patients is that the length of treatment for kidney infections should be much longer. So a typical kidney infection in PKD patients needs about 4 weeks minimum of antibiotics. And in non-PKD patients, typically 2 weeks is enough. And the other difference is that for non-PKD patients, we just want the antibiotic to get to the urine. Whereas here, we have to think about cysts and we have to choose agents that actually penetrate into the cell, into the cyst. And typically, the ones that have very good penetration are quinolones, such as Cipro or Levaquin, and Bactrim and vancomycin. The group that is actually poor in penetrating the cyst is the class of penicillins and cephalosporins that actually have good urinary penetration, but they don't get into the cyst as well. And we should think about that, particularly when you're thinking about kidney infection or cyst infection. For bladder infection, it doesn't matter that much, unless you know the bladder infection has been ascending to the kidneys. Chronic pain is also a very, very common problem in polycystic kidney disease. There is a correlation between kidney size and pain, but the correlation is not perfect. We all have those patients who would have relatively smaller kidneys and they're hurting a lot. And I've had patients who have massively, massively enlarged kidneys and they don't have that much of pain. They may have some discomfort as far as the size, but not really painful. Obviously, if the pain is very severe, and chronic and daily, you know, it can affect your social job performance, your mood, your, you know, mental health. And pain management a lot of times comes to the picture. So you can go from simple giving some Tylenol to, you know, narcotic prescription. Now with the narcotic issues that we have to be careful about the risk of dependence and tolerance and try to use everything before that. And then the cyst drainage, you know, by needle drainage could be used. My colleague at the Harvard, Ted Steinman, has actually developed a very predictive model that works really well. If the area of the pain corresponds to a major or two major or three major cysts that are much larger than the other ones, and that's where the patient is hurting, and the size is at least 3 to 4 centimeters, going after those individual cysts has actually a pretty high yield in relieving the pain. And you would know that because as soon as you put the needle in there, patients say, wow, my pain is almost 80% or 60% or 90% gone. But if the cysts are all over the place and there are too many of them and the size is kind of all over the place, usually it does not help, you know, going after those individual cysts, and it actually may hurt them to have more pain. And have, you know, complications of infections and things like that. The more radical treatment is cyst roofing, which is a surgical procedure. It was very commonly performed in the 80s and 90s, and we kind of backed away from those because we realized that it actually does not help protecting the kidney function. If anything, when you do cyst roofing, you're also removing some good tissue, and the kidney function may go down. But the major, major problem with those is that if we end up in a situation of non-healing and oozing intra-abdominal wounds, then you get ascites, and that becomes a really complicated situation. And a lot of times, you know, you basically have to go and take the kidney out. There are some other more invasive treatments, such as renal sympathetic denervation. That's invasive. It should be done by a group that is really familiar with that, and it should be only considered in patients who have really excruciating pain that is refractory to the typical treatment plans that we have. Another associated feature of polycystic kidney disease is actually liver cysts. Liver cysts are extremely common. If you want to just go by a presence of one cyst and look at all PKD patients, at least 75% of them would have at least one cyst at some point of their life. Most people have more than one. And if you look at the end of life, you know, pretty much 90% of them have at least one cyst. The interesting thing about these cysts is that they don't cause liver failure. They don't cause liver cirrhosis, but they can cause, you know, mechanical compression issues with rupture, infections. And also, you know, if the liver is extremely big, then it can actually cause malnutrition because you don't have room to eat food and you basically chronically become malnourished. There are some strategies as far as either medications, somatostatin analogs and octreotide have shown actually a reduction of the cyst, which is moderate, but they also come with the risks of inducing diabetes. And also, you know, you have to see whether the insurance companies will cover that drug. One of my patients just recently, you know, the insurance said we're not covering that indication. And as far as the surgical options, if the left liver, which is the much, much smaller part of the liver, is actually involved and it's very big and it's pushing against the stomach, you can actually very easily resect that. And that gives people more room to eat. And I've used that trick in many of my patients with these situations. But then the larger cyst roofing surgery is more complicated. And again, you know, it has more post-op issues as far as healing and infections and scarring, but it can be considered as well. The next very important topic is actually screening and detection and treatment of intracranial aneurysms. And I'm going to ask Michelle to go over that.
Thanks, Fred. I agree with you. This is really a key clinical area that we need to pay attention in patients with polycystic kidney disease. And as we know, it presents in 10 to 12% of all screened PKD patients. Usually it's in the 75% these aneurysms are located in the arterial circulation. It's important to remember that these aneurysms are more important in families with histories of intracranial aneurysm. It's not only intracranial aneurysm, but also dolichoectasias, which means an elongation, dilation without really of the vessel, without an aneurysm, and that can happen in approximately 5% of cases. We need usually to screen, screening needs to be offered to those patients who are obviously symptomatic, like headaches, positive family history of stroke or cerebrovascular events, high-risk jobs. The job that always comes to mind is obviously an airline pilot or pre-transplant or any other type of surgery. There's no question that an MRA of the brain without gadolinium is recommending as the first-line screening tool. If this one is negative, there's no need to repeat it for another 5 to 10 years. Obviously, we need to avoid uncontrolled hypertension, smoking, heavy alcohol consumption, all kind of logical things in the management of aneurysms, as well as stimulant medications, illicit drugs, and excessive straining and Valsalva maneuvers. The foam embolization or surgical clipping is needed if the site is greater than 7 millimeters. However, some patients might really be very concerned if the site is smaller and request consultation with some of our neurosurgical colleagues. Fred, do you want to maybe summarize kind of the nutritional recommendation for this population?
Sure. The main things based on the studies that have been done, we recommend a moderate protein restriction diet in ADPKD, and that's based on the MDRD study that had a fair number of PKD patients in that. And over long term, that's an effective intervention. From the Hall PKD study, we clearly linked urinary sodium excretion, which basically reflects your salt intake. And we know that when you're eating more salt and when you're excreting more salt in the urine, that is a risk factor for kidney growth and also to the drop in GFR and death and ESRD. And this is data from HALT-PKD trial. So we're really adamant about that. It could be actually a completely new way of not only treating hypertension, but also prolonging the kidney life in polycystic kidney disease. High water, the same way that tolvaptan blocks, you know, the vasopressin effect, you know, if you drink a lot of water, you can suppress vasopressin. We know that from this single study that was done, it was a relatively small study in Japan, they did not actually show a clear difference in either kidney size or kidney function. But again, there were caveats with that study. It was a small study. There's a much larger study right now in Australia that's going on, and we'll have the results hopefully by the end of the year. caffeine in animal models of polycystic kidney disease clearly fuels, you know, fluid secretion in ADPKD and increased size of the kidneys. In human studies, when we looked at HALT-PKD and CRISP retrospective data after the studies were done, and we knew whether patients were taking caffeine or not, we did not see much of a difference between caffeine consumers and versus non-consumers. Caffeine clearly can still worsen the blood pressure. We don't recommend smoking at all, both in animal models and in human studies. The risk of progression of kidney disease is higher in smokers. And obesity, and as Michelle already talked about from the HALT-PKD trial, obesity and being overweight is clearly associated with faster progression, both in change of kidney volume and slope of the decline of kidney function. So those are the things that have been established. Now, the ketogenic diet and time-restricted fasting are very hot topics, and there's some animal models that have shown that, and the clinical trials that are pilot studies are ongoing. So we're waiting for the results, and hopefully we'll have larger trials to go over the final results of those interventions. As a summary, take-home message, what would you recommend if I wanted to point out five strategies for PKD patients? What would be the take-home message to take care of these patients?
Yeah, thank you, Fred. I think a lot of the key treatment areas have had an impact in our PKD patient population, as we know that the longevity of this patient is increasing steadily with more than 10 years over the last 40 years. If you would ask me, I think hypertension is probably the most common and treatable associated complication in PKD. We need to do our best to lower to a systolic blood pressure of 110 in those with a GFR greater than 60, and at least a systolic blood pressure of 130, if not 120, in those who have more advanced polycystic kidney disease. We need to screen and treat for intracranial aneurysm. I cannot stress this more, as this could be a devastating complication in patients with polycystic kidney disease, especially in those who have a family history of aneurysm. We need to remember that the vasopressin receptor antagonist, olbaptan, should be considered in all patients at high risk of progression, because it's the only modifying drug that has been really approved by the FDA. And as you mentioned, we will talk about the dietary interventions, low salt, protein restriction, high water intake, as well as avoiding cigarette smoking in this population as other kind of countercurrent measures to improve the outcomes of PKD patients.
Thank you very much, Michelle, for all your help and input in this presentation. I hope that this webcast has been useful for the audience.
You have been listening to CME on ReachMD. This activity is jointly provided by Access Medical Education and Novus Medical Education, and is supported by an educational grant from Otsuka America Pharmaceutical Incorporated. To receive your free CME credit or to download this activity, go to reachmd.com/CME. Thank you for listening.